Should have explained at the beginning of these talks that there is a sort of a series running through the titles where they follow a pattern. I didn't indicate that, as generally speaking, the meaning of life is, if you like, growth, if you like, evolution. If you like, it's becoming the one, becoming the God, return to God, or if you like, movement towards God. But it isn't just movement, it really is becoming what you are. Anyway, I did indicate that the basis of meaning in life was contained in the concept of oneness. So the first was the wonder of oneness. Today we're going to diverge a little into a slightly different subject, but a subject in which the Pythagoreans tried to find meaning in life by the study of numbers and by mathematics. Then the third subject will be universal mind, which is an attempt to understand consciousness in the lower forms of life. Consciousness which is, to a far greater extent than human consciousness, integral with the One. And then the fourth is the veiling of the separate focus, which is the way in which human consciousness, which is the separate focus and self-conscious, the way in which that works. And the fifth is the laws that govern life. And there we just beginning to get into the ethical field. The sixth is a growth towards God, or if you like, a self-realization. And the seventh is excess baggage, that which we carry with us, which we don't require on the journey back to the One. And the eighth. is love is essential, because love is that which leads us to an understanding of oneness. So I'd like you to be aware that there is a pattern in the sequence of the talks. As I said, this one's a little out on a limb. Now, Akash is the super sensuous, and you'll be able to follow your notes a little better, I think, because I rewrote a bit of this to fit in better with the notes. Akash is the supersensuous spiritual essence which pervades all space. It has been described as primordial substance, which is like we've done in theosophy. We give a name to something and then think we understand it. And primordial substance is the name we gave to it. Within Akasha exist all possible forms, appearances, and energies, and upon it can be impressed limitless numbers of features and happenings, all that was, is, and will be. The One becomes the many by the action of Fohat, or basic energy, digging holes in space, or Akasha. Now, I'm just stating this in my own way. I know that you've had many talks on the secret doctrine to cover this subject better than I do, but this is a lead-in to what I'm going to say later. The only attribute of Akasha is said to be sound. That's creative sound. The logos means word, and therefore sound. And in the beginning was the word, and the word was God, and the word was with God, and the word was God. Sound or vibration is the basic creator of forms. Now I'll show some slides to indicate that. The universe is created by vibration, maintained by vibration, and destroyed by vibration. Now, vibration is wave motion, and in spite of what you think, waves don't move. Waves are just a building up and a falling away, a building up and a falling away. They don't move laterally. Although when the wind hits the top of them, they appear to, because the top is blown over. So wave motion is a vibration, but it's not a movement, backwards or forwards. The universe is created by vibration. I'm sorry, I read that. The vibration underlying all creation is cosmic sound, sound in its most comprehensive sense. Shabda Brahma, it is called in Sanskrit. And this sound comes from Akasha as Nada, the one primary vibration, the integrated state of vibration, from which all possible kinds of vibration emanate, and an infinite variety of forms, or an infinite variety of vibrations, which produce an infinite number of forms. So Akash can be described as space, primordial substance. But this gives you an idea of a void. But of course it isn't a void, strictly speaking, because in it there is the limitless potential. And behind it, or within it, is pure consciousness. And pure consciousness is the one reality. And consciousness alone can produce out of itself any amount of energy and any number of form. Now the spaces in which the worlds of different degrees of subtlety function is called Siddhakasha, or mental space. Well, we have already said that space is to us, or space as we know it, is an illusion. But there evidently is, according to the Eastern tradition, a real space, a Mahakasha, which lies at the basis of space as we know it. And everything in the world, which is in the world of the unreal, as we know it by the senses, is a reflection or a shadow of that one reality. Now, you know the illustration used by Plato, where he had the prisoner sitting in the cave, looking at the back of the cave with the front of the opening of the cave behind him. And the sunlight streamed in the opening of the cave, and it cast shadows of those who were walking past. So all he actually saw were the shadows of those people who were living in the reality of the world of the sun, you know, bathed in sunlight. So you see, it's generally speaking, we are looking at the shadows, not at the reality. Consciousness itself is built on this vibratory foundation, and it is said by Mr. E.L. Gardner that there is a sweeping ebb and flow of incredible speed in the action of consciousness. As contact is made with an object, the personal sense impacts are experienced. All things are in fact a succession of impacts on the primordial substance, which he calls the web of the universe. And he says it's like a cinema picture of the objective world about us, because it seems to be a continuous and unbroken concept, but many times a second, that which we see changes from positive to negative, as it were, and we are actually seeing, as you do in the cinema, a whole lot of sensory perceptions which are pulsing, the great rhythm. I think this is an extremely interesting idea, because when there is that rhythm, where is that change from positive to negative, there is the possibility of growth. So it means that nothing in our consciousness is really stable. It's always in the present moment in a state of movement. And therefore we can change ourselves, we can change our understanding of things. Now I think we should have the first slide now, if we could have the next. This is Mr. Gardner's concept of the web of the universe. That which stands beyond or behind material matter as we know it in the world. It was an individual clairvoyant experience he had. I don't know of anybody else who's described it in the same way. But to me, it's a very helpful experience. I think you will all agree that clairvoyant experiences by various people are sort of latch in at a different point. And so they're not all the same, and some are quite different in that they illuminate one aspect of that which we are studying, whereas others illuminate another aspect. So he saw the whole of this primordial substance as a background of interlacing lines. Now, where the lines met in this here, you get actually spots. It's just going, is it? Oh, no. Not very, not very.
You can use a pointer, Jack.
Possibly. This are the interlacing, these are the lines, these points of light. Where everything meets, where it meets, where it comes down and meets, you get these points of light. And it's in those points of light, of course, that the energy, or what we call matter, appears to exist. That's all right, I found it. I'm sorry, I'm fishing. That's it more in more detail, but the one that shows it best is this one. Now, the energy appears to flow in three different ways. It goes up and over, and it doesn't flow actually like this. It flows more in a curve. So it flows in three ways. I did trace these out once. It goes down and round and round, and then it goes down and round and round, and there's another one, down and round and round. So if it starts there and goes to there, diagonally across, it has three different ways of achieving that. You see what I'm getting at? And down there. And all these points where the web crosses appear as energy points of light. Oh, I'll go back to this one again. The power current pursues a curved course, leaping spirally from junction point to junction point, dividing into three in between, as I said, following three paths, and therefore connecting diagonal points in three different ways from the opposite corner of the cube. So there are three ways of getting from junction to junction, all at right angles. Flashes of light at junction points appear like streaming beads of light in lines spirally curved. It is against this fabric of the web that the cosmic breath plays, revealing the relationships of life to form. Various forms and qualities of vibration produce forms. So sound, as we have seen, is the primary creating vibration. Sound, is, as we know it, is a very, very distant relative of that one sound, which is the word or the creative sound, but it is of the same nature. It just got buried deeply in the lower worlds of manifestation. You will see this mantric sound as it is described in the Gayatri by Dr. Timely, and you will read much more about it in music forms, for instance, by Jeffrey Hodson. But I'd just like to show you one or two small slides. I thought there was one before that.
Yes, I'll have to push it down.
I'd have to push down. I'll see what happens if I go back. My slides are a little dog-eared through being used, and this machine doesn't like them. No, that's not it. There isn't one. It doesn't matter. It was, we did have it on before. What's happened then? Oh. Anyway, the other was little diagrams that were produced by putting sand on a drum and singing a pure note. Each pure note produced a particular form. This was done by some years ago by a Mrs. Watts Hughes. And in the same way, a pure note, when sung, can produce a tree form, and this is one that was produced that way by the human voice, a form built in semi-liquid medium by the human voice. Now the others, that's why I wanted to show them, were completely geometrical, the ones that were produced by the sand on the drum. Now this has a natural shape, and this is something that I find very interesting, that both could be produced by sound and by the sound of a human voice. Oh, well, the other shapes on the drum were similar to these. These actually are ice crystals, and there you can see that this basic creative sound has produced an infinite number of geometrical figures in each ice crystal. They're all different, thousands of them. And this again is one of the most mind-boggling concepts you can have of the ability of nature to produce an infinite number of forms, and you get the same thing in crystals, an infinite number of forms, all of which conform to an overall pattern, but have individual characteristics and individual pattern of their own. I think that's enough. I'd like just to read a little more. Perhaps I could do it without pulling the slides. Now we saw within the web of life spirals within spirals. And we talked last, on Tuesday, about holism and fields within fields. The ultimate mystery in this concept is that the whole can exist in a point, the bindu. And there again, Dr. Timely has written in Man, God, and the Universe a great deal about this concept of everything existing in the point. And quoting from the Ordered Universe by Corona True, every whole is a completely self-contained unit, which at its own level is endlessly extensive and without limit for that which has and without limit for that which has experience within it. Within the whole there is no limit to the experience of that which is inside, but there is a limitation by what she calls the ring pass not, that which confines it. Only energies as a fact of experience, when life or only energies as a fact of experience, where life or consciousness seeks to step out from the level or standpoint of that unit into a larger and inclusive sphere of activity. I haven't put this very well. I think what she means is that inside that ring pass knot, and the skin of the body is one of those ring pass knots, everything can act in a pattern, in a habitual pattern. But once you get outside that ring pass knot, you're in totally different circumstances and new things happen. And divine arithmetic is something like a point within a circle. Now, remember Radha lectured on this. The point contains everything within, but it is still within the ring pass knot of the circle. And it is said by the Pythagoreans and others who studied this, that the point can become numbers, numerous numbers, by movement within the circle. Once it gets outside the circle, then you slip into a new dimension, four-dimensional or something like that. Now, the point, when it moves, creates a line. So you've immediately got not duality, but you've got really a triplicity, a trinity. You've got a point at each end of the line, and you've got the line between the two points. And then remember, I said that there's no one end to a stick. There's no flat figure, what's the word I want there? Flat surface figure that can be, no regular figure that can be enclosed by two lines. We've got a circle enclosed by one line, we've got a triangle enclosed by three lines. But any other figure is an irregular figure. It doesn't conform to a proper geometrical shape. So sound and vibrations are the creative force by which the one becomes the manifested world. But the intelligent control through universal mind, the intelligent control of this process of sound creating form, the intelligent control of that is by mathematics, especially by arithmetic and geometry. And all this comes about from the one, which is primary, the second, which comes from the one, the two, and the which is necessary for the creation of a dual world for consciousness to play through. And thirdly, from that comes the relationship between the one and the two, the Trinity. Now, I think you can probably see it on here. yes, thank you very much. If you consider the one as A, the capital A, which is primary, then if you take the B as that which is manifested in matter, A is primary, Atma, B is that which is manifested in matter, the duality, and C is that which is the link between the two, which is consciousness. Now, you can break this up. You know, a computer works actually on the binary principle, A and B, but there is always, for a message to come out from the computer, there is always a linking up between those two. That's your third aspect, the sattva, that which always reveals the nature of the relationship of the other two. And for manifestation to be possible, the one must take on apparent duality, and from these two arises the Trinity. And from the Trinity, in turn, rises the seven, the nature, the number of nature. Now the capital letters represent that which is dominant in the relationship, and the small letters that which is of secondary importance. So we have, first, the A dominant, the B and C, less dominant, secondary, the B dominant, and so on, the C dominant, the A and the B dominant, B and the C dominant, and the C and the A dominant, and then lastly, A, B, and C all dominant. Now, I did an exercise some time ago of setting out all those seven, like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and making each of those, first of all, the one dominant and everything else secondary, and then the two dominant and everything else secondary, the three dominant. You get into some hundreds of combinations that way. But if you took each of those again and did the same thing, you would get into billions. And to me, there is here the possibility of a mathematical explanation of the the variety of individual unique qualities in a mathematical sense. Just as there was when the white light was split into the colored spectrum, there was there an infinite number of gradations of vibration. So in numbers, we can get the same thing. Now, 7 is made up of 1 multiplied by 2 multiplied by 3 plus 1, which is very interesting. And it is said that we have the same thing in the human body, in the arm. We've got the A here, the 1 here, the 2 in the lower arm, and the 5 fingers, which are that which do things, make up the 7. Anyway, it was Pythagoras who established a science of numbers which had a spiritual and ethical basis. And he and those he taught sought meaning in life through a study of numbers and of mathematics. He taught these subjects at his school in Crotona, of course, in Italy, which is considered by many to have been the first university for lay people. And in it were taught such varied subjects as medicine, physics, electronics. Many of the books I've read have said that electronics were taught in those days. And you know that there has been the remains of a battery discovered in the Aegean Sea somewhere. They taught astronomy, music, and humming strings. Now the humming strings, he divided the humming strings up. He experimented with the string that it can be held at various points and vibrates between those various points, which is a purely mathematical analysis of music. And from that, of course, he wrote a musical scale. I won't go into this anymore. Now Porphyry, writing of Pythagoras, said, he regarded religion, science, and philosophy as one, the combined purpose of which was to enable man to become the likeness of God. With this purpose ever in mind, he became the founder of a way of life which was developed by his pupil Plato in a form which had a great impact on the Western world. And some of the scientists now suggest it wasn't a good impact. I'm not sure I can go along with that, but I don't know enough. He was Pythagoras was a scientific investigator, the humming strings, but more importantly, he was a philosopher. He speculated on the universe and sought the source of all being in the immaterial and the eternal. Philosophy transcends science, and he also understood holism, as we do today. The principle of things cannot be learned by surveying the parts of things alone. They must be considered as a whole. He went further than his predecessors, who limited themselves to speculation about nature. He sought to direct the lives of men towards living in harmony with nature. He knew the harmony of the spheres, that celestial bodies could be experienced as sound. And he, of course, was a vegetarian, and there were no blood sacrifices in his school, whatever you may read in other books. Just a few words about him. We could have the lights out again. Thank you. I could talk for an awful long time about
five fibers. All that is.
Go back. That is one cast of Pythagoras. He was born about 580 BC, probably in Sidon, near Beirut, a little town. I have been there, and that there's fighting going on there at the moment. He probably was born there, but really his father came from Samos. This is the island of Samos in the Aegean. He was a jeweler. It was prophesied, of course, that Pythagoras would be a very great person. He would be a wisdom person following Apollo. He left home at 18 years of age, the same age as HPB left home. And he went, of course, to Phoenicia, which in those days, which is now Sidon and Beirut, and then down the coast to Egypt. As he went down the coast to Egypt, the captain of the ship thought of selling him into slavery, but a storm came up, and he was able to quell the storm, so the story goes. And he landed in Egypt with the full blessings of the crew of that ship, which is quite an achievement. He waited in Egypt 5 years before he was admitted into the mystery schools, both at Memphis and Sais. Sais is the temple of Isis. I don't think there's any remains left. It's between Alexandria and Cairo. But he spent, I think, 25 years in Egypt, learning all that the Egyptian priests could teach him. But he was captured by the Persians and taken back to Persia, where he learnt the astronomy and the astrology and the mathematics and various other things from the Chaldeans. He left there to go to India. He may have met the Buddha, who was alive at the same time. He may have met Lao Tse, who also was alive at the same time. And Confucius was a boy. This, to me, is very interesting, that all these people should have been alive at the same time. He went to Tibet, and he returned to Samos, but couldn't start up his school. It didn't work. So he went to Greece, Italy, France, Iberia, Spain, Britain, returned to Samos, and then he started his school without outstanding success. But there was ruling in Samos at that time a man who made things very difficult, and there was a threat of invasion from the Turkish mainland. So he decided with 600 of his students to move to Crotona in Italy, where he set up his school. He was 50 years of age then. He carried on his school possibly for 30 or 40 years. It's very indefinite what actually happened to him at the end. He probably went to, this name I always get tied up, Metapontum, which is up the coast. I'm not sure that I got the name right. And his wife, Theano, carried on. He is said by some to have died at 80 years of age, and others lived to 100. Now, his school was in three groups. The akustikoi, those who were the hearers and just listened, and the mathematikoi, those who studied mathematics, and the ones who were in the inner school were called psychokoi, and they, of course, were the students of esoteric philosophy. Now, he taught the science of numbers, which included the science of vibration, humming strings, and music. The theory of magnitude. Magnitude at rest was geometry. Magnitude in motion was astronomy. To the Pythagoreans, numbers were the key to all natural secrets and universal harmonies. HPB in The Secret Doctrine says, Numbers are a key to the ancient view of cosmogony and the evolution of the human race, and all systems of religious mysticisms are based on numerals. And the sacredness of numbers begins with the great first cause, the one, and ends only with the zero, which is the symbol of infinity. The science of numbers was taught in the inner group. To Pythagoras, God was one and not out of this world, but entirely in the world. And in the emanation of all things from the one, geometry is the framework, and arithmetic the basis of geometry. The Pythagoreans had the ability to apply their maths, but their real aim was to use maths in their search for understanding of the visible and invisible world. It's a mystical approach, the one that Dr. Roger Jones was talking about, and one that we find today rather hard to understand.
Oh, sorry, that's famous. Equitable time. Pythagoras again. I should have been showing you these, they're not very important. That's his monument in Athens. Now, this isn't very grand, or perhaps as good as we can get on the side.
Anyway, these are the numbers as the Pythagoreans looked upon them. They were made up of atoms or units. And these units could be infinitesimally small, and yet they could be infinitesimally small, but they did not have decimals because they realized that a decimal actually is a number. So they saw little significance. I wouldn't say they didn't have decimals, but they didn't look upon decimals as a number. So they saw little significance in fractions or parts of numbers, except those which were indeterminate or irrational, and I'll refer to those later. The secret doctrine notes that God is pleased with an odd number because it reveals the one. The ancients considered them perfect, masculine, and godlike, while even numbers were terrestrial and female. The odd numbers were definite and therefore good. I'm surprised at this. It's very much a masculine attitude towards that. I'll apologize. The one represented God. The one is therefore spiritually important. One is the first odd number, although you'll see later that... Now, these actually are the ways in which the numbers were made up by the Hindus. I must have missed this bit. The numbers we use came from the Indian form and not from the Roman numerals. And this is the way the Indian form was created. And you see the 4, the 5, very similar, the 6, the 7, the 8 was this, and the 9 that, which is interesting. They came from these combinations of the units or dots. Now, this is the one I really wanted. This is the Pythagorean one. These are the odd numbers, 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, which were considered to be godlike because they revealed the one. 5 is 2 plus 1 plus 2. But here you have the even numbers, which were not godlike, materialistic, they represent matter or material, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. So whenever you add two of those together, you get an even number. Now, they said one had tremendous power, because when you add one to an even number, you get an odd number. When you add one to an odd number, you get an even number. Are you with me? But when you add an even number to an even number, you get an even number. This was significant to them. That means that the one was that which was important. The two, or duality, represents matter, which is, of course, essential to manifestation, but was considered passive or indeterminate, representing the Earth Mother. Two is just one plus one. It is the reflection of the one. And each number is equal to the sum of the numbers before it. I don't know if I've got this on the next one. I don't think I have. So you see, the number three is 2 plus 4, which is 6, divided by 2, which is 3. But the number one has got nothing before it. It's got 2 afterwards, but it's got nothing before it. So it was considered the source of all numbers because it had nothing before it. And the duality, 1 plus 2 becomes 3, which is the balance, the Trinity. It is complete in itself and in reality is the first number. It creates the triangle, which is the symbol of the deity. The number 4 to the Pythagoreans was the great miracle god under another name. It was the fountain of nature and the key bearer. It introduces order from the divine Trinity into the manifested world, and its mystic significance of the link between the human and the divine was the greatest importance to the Pythagoreans. It was perfect and sacred, the tetrad. I'll show you that in a moment. 5 also generated unity, and there was a number of balance, energy and light, and 5-pointed star is generated from the number 5. I'll refer to 6 later. 7 also generated from the one and the Trinity. It's the one and the Trinity which give you 4, and another Trinity gives you 7. 360 is an interesting number because it was used for the degrees in a circle, and it must have been used, I'm not sure, but I think it must have been used in the ancient world as well. And 360 is an interesting number because it can be divided by every other number except 1. 7. So somehow or other there's significance in that. 8 was not considered significant. 9 was, because it's the 7, the sacred number of life, plus 2, the sacred number of being and becoming. 10, of course, is the complete number. I will talk about that later. Now, 6 was an interesting number. It was a perfect number, because 3 plus 1, plus 2 plus 1 equals 6. And those are the factors in it, you see. It's 3, and also 3 multiplied by 2 multiplied by 1 is 6. And there are not many numbers like that. There are a few. 28 is another one. And there is and there are some others. Now, Pythagoras used to have what he called friendly numbers. He said, what is a friend? A friend is an I, the same as you, a person who is you in another way. And he had numbers that represented friendship. One of them was 220. Now, if you break 220 down, you get 1 into its factors, 1 and 22 and 44 and 5 and so on and so on. I won't go into them here. You get 284. And if you break 284 down into its factors and add them all together, then you get 220. So to him, 220 and 284 were friendship numbers. Now there are 2 other friendship numbers, 172296 and 18416. And I wonder who worked those out. You'd have worked those into factors. It should take up pages. Never mind, they are. Now we're getting pretty near the time, but I would like to introduce to you. What can we do?
Practice.
It is, I hope to be a little further on before tea, but never mind. It is the, we can come back to it. It is the numbers 1, 2, 3, up to 10 in a pyramid form.
1 plus 2 plus 3 plus 4 equals 10. And this is the way in which they considered the 4 became the 10. It was a sacred number, the Pythagoreans, and was the basis of their oath of integrity. It is the triangular 10 formed from the first four numbers, but is really a symbol of the generating power of the 4, which from the unknowable 3 generates the 7, which together form the complete whole, and that is, the work is fully accomplished. We use that 10 and 10 fingers of our hand. And if you take the 10 and one below and one above, you've got the 12, which is another significant number. The 10 was spoken of as the heaven to which all men will ultimately go, or eternity, the fountain of eternal nature. The meaning is explained in the secret doctrine, but the references are frequent, but they scattered and hard to pick up. I've got a few of them. Now, we should really to understand it, look at as it was in the yods, which of course is the Hebrew way of making the units complete a number. And this came, of course, from Egypt and Chaldea. The white dots, the three dots at the corner represent the divine in its three aspects. But these must link with the central dot at the bottom here. The central dot, the 4, represents the monad in man, the spiritual nature in man, which is one with the divine. HPB says, the Pythagorean Tetractys is a symbol of the cosmos. In the consideration of the Tetractys, which is the 10, the important things are the 3, the Trinity, which represents God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Ghost, or if you like, Osiris, Isis, and Horus. And the center point is that which links man with that divine Trinity. And that is the monad in man. And you see, that's why it was sacred to the Pythagoreans. So if that's clear, then these other 6 here are the principles of man, which are linked through the monad to the divine. Again, if you get that clear, you understand the picture. Now, it's interesting to see that if we have this triangle here, which is the Tetractys, that we can actually put 2 points here and there, 3 more points, which represent God coming down into involution, and then you get the interlaced triangles. And the basis of the interlaced triangles are these 6 points, which represent the 6 principles in man, plus the center. And the interlaced triangles should always be drawn with that center, because they're more or less meaningless without it. Because it is the monad that links the human or any form of life with the Godhead. Now, Patrick's had the lights now. There are 7 causal or personal principles in man, and that is the Atma, the highest, the monad. And that links with the 3. If I can make that clear, the whole thing becomes a lot easier. Here's my stick. The Tetrarch is extended through the 4, the generator, to make a solid figure. That's the next one. Okay. I lose myself. Now, the same thing can be done by extending it. You see, here you have the 3, Father, Mother, Son, or Holy Ghost, if you like, because the Christian Trinity never seemed right to me. Then you take the central point, the 4, and you extend it upwards to the 1, and you have the tetrahedron, which is, of course, the symbol of the unity of the one with that the manifested world. And the manifested world, it always has the Trinity in it, plus the principles of the human. Now, the four, actually, if we go back one, the four is one third of the way up, which is interesting. You get the area of that by, no, I'm sorry, it's the tetrahedron. You get the area of the tetrahedron by multiplying it by one third of the height. And the one third of the way up is very important because it's the balance in a triangular solid figure. And in the Great Pyramid, it's the point at which the King's Chamber is. And that's why it focuses a particular power. And you've possibly read about pyramid power, and it is quite true that they discovered an animal in the King's Chamber which did not rot because of the energies. And you can sharpen razor blades and all those sort of things, and it does happen. If you have the proper orientation, if you have a pyramid that is aligned to the north and has the right dimensions, the dimensions of the Pyramid of Giza. So you see, this four represents that third of the way up, which is very important. Now, these are the six, and there again you've got the two. These are the six principles. There are the divine aspects, and there are the four which links with the three and generates the seven. Because the six by themselves, as HPB said, are unstable, but the four gives them stability. In other words, Atma is everything. The six are dependent upon Atma. Atma plays right down through all our principles, and it is for us that which is life. Now, if you take this one, you get the six taken out with the center again, the spokes of the wheel, which is Thor's hammer, which appears, is like the swastika. It sort of shows how life comes into the six and is generated by the whirling effect. And these are like the tongues of flame that you've got in the swastika, which are, as it were, trailing behind when the movement takes place. There are only three movements in this. It shows the three-dimensional swastika. If you look at that, you may find it difficult to look at it in three dimensions, perhaps, but if you do, if you can see that in three dimensions, you get the three movements that a ship would take. That is, it pitches up and down, it rolls sideways, and it goes off course and back on course. And those are, of course, the three movements within the three dimensions. Now, this is a more difficult diagram, comes straight from the secret doctrine, but it's a carry-on or development of that which is in the Tetractys. The point in the circle is the manifested logos, which is always the symbol of the one within the circle. God is absolute life and absolute sound or form. The circle is the field in which manifestation can take place. The circle has one line. It's a regular figure, but one line only. The triangle is therefore the next regular figure, because as I said, there's no regular figure with two lines, and it corresponds to motion, color, and sound. Thus, the point in the triangle represents the second logos, the life flowing into manifestation from the divine. Here's the life flowing into manifestation from the divine. It is father mother, or the white ray, which is no color, since it potentially includes all colors and vibrations. It radiates from the unmanifest logos, or unspoken word. From the same ray, through this center, the four is formed, because that is in the position in the tetrad where we had the four.
from the same ray through this center, four is formed, and from this forms the square, the manifested matter. The square has always been the symbol of matter, and of course it goes into the four-dimensional cube, the three-dimensional cube. And from it, the cube, or the world of form. And the other diagram over here, the upper triangle represents the spiritual triad in man, again with the Atma, the center here, and representing the spiritual triad of will, love, wisdom, and activity, or love activity, the three aspects of the Trinity. The central dot is the generating center, the monad, which is the highest Atma, links with the universal God. The square is the lower quaternary, the physical body, the vital or etheric body, the astral body of feeling, and the lower mind, which make up the personality or mask of man. So you can see the spiritual nature, Atman, coming down into the physical personality of man. The triangle below is the divine trinity, reversed and reflected below the seven. This is one of just a indications in the secret doctrine, this reflection of the divine below the seven, below the lowest physical level. One of the great occult mysteries, understood by adepts and unfortunately by black magicians. Now I think we can ask about this. We'll go skip through the others quickly. This is a very beautiful drawing about the platonic solids, showing the platonic solids by Claude Bragdon, who some of you may know. His books were magnificent. Only The Frozen Fountain has been republished, as far as I know, but a lot of his illustrations have been used in the American Theosophist. These are the regular solids, the cube, the tetrahedron, I think that's the octahedron, and so on. I was going to go into this more fully, but I'm not fully prepared in that. But the important thing in the platonic solids, this is from Jinraja Das's First Principles, which shows all of them. There are five of full importance. There's one other. What is it? The sphere. The sphere is also not shown there. This one, I think, is generates a sphere. This generates the sphere. But no, the sphere isn't shown there. It's usually taken as the absolute, the one reality, because it is, as I said in my earlier lecture, like the seamless coat of reality. It's featureless. It's one.
Could it denote the ring past not?
Yes, yes. It's like a circle. It is a ring past not. Yeah. Now, the axes of growth are the important things in considering the solids, the platonic solids, and it's usually a cross of that form, a three-dimensional cross. And this is the basis of growth for crystals and various other things. They haven't been the basis of growth for all nature. And the platonic solids have been linked to the atomic scale, what's the word I want? The atomic weights of numbers and the periodic scale. And it has a significance right throughout the study of these things. I won't go into it tonight because I haven't fairly prepared this. But if you follow through this three-dimensional cross, you will find that that is the basis. One of the bases, I'll show you what I consider as the other bases. Well, this is linked with the tattvas, but again, I'm not going to go into that tonight. Now we come to the theorem of Pythagoras, which was not really invented by Pythagoras. It was known by the Sumerians and known by the Egyptians. And they used this one, 3, 4, 5,
3 squared is 9, plus 4 squared is 16, gives you 25. And there it is set out. Now, that triangle was used by the Egyptian, and is still used, for making a right angle, for setting out buildings. Now, there are some others. Do you know what the other ones are? No, any others? I've got them written down, I can remember. 20, 11, and 29, 9, 40, and 41, 24, 25, and 7, or 7, 24, and 25. But that's about all. Now, in every other, oh, before we go, I should show you, right on that far board, can you see that? Just switch on light, just for a second. That's the way they proved. They put 25 dots down, and they put a line round that left 9 outside and 16 inside. So 16 plus 9 is 25. Now if we go to a huge lot, 2 pages to prove the theorem of Pythagoras in a geometric examination, you may have done. But they did it in that very simple way. But you see, the point is that this is only a particular case. In every other case, you get one of these, say you make that 4 and 5, then you get a root here, a square root, which always is indeterminate. Now indeterminate is like a third of 10. A third of 10 is 3.333 on to infinity. And it's said by historians that the Pythagoreans were scared of the irrational or indeterminate root. I don't think they were. I think this is wrong. I think they looked upon it with a sense of awe because it went on into infinity. In other words, it was unmeasurable. The only right angle triangles that are measurable are those that have a mathematical equation for the square on the hypotenuse plus the square on the other two sides. And as I said, there are only 4 or 5 of them. So every other one was immeasurable. You can never measure the side on another. You see, that was what was important to them, because this being unmeasurable to them meant a sort of an indication of the nature of the infinite. That's my way of thinking. Or here, there's some ways you can do it by cutting up, sorry it's a bad slide, you can cut up little bits and fit them in, and this is a joke about it there. And this is Pythagoras smelling a flower. Now, if you fitted all those bits together, you would get the same sort of figure as I've got before. In other words, you can prove that the square on the hypotenuse is equal to the square on the other two sides by these mechanical means of cutting it up into various shapes. You can do that for any triangle at all. Now, the next thing we come to is the golden mean. Now, I think this was the proportion that Felt talked about when the society was founded in New York in 1975, the lost proportion of the Egyptians. I can't think of any other proportion. This is the only one. A is to B, as B is to A plus B. Or it's usually put 1.618 to 1 and 1 to 1.618. It's worked out with a root 5. That actually is how it's done, and that won't interest you very much. But this, do you want to ask me questions about that?
Yeah, I'm lost.
Completely lost. Well, forget about the mathematics. Forget about the mathematics and look at this one. This is actually the same proportion added to that to get this, which is added to that to get that. A is to B. When you add A is to B as B is to A plus B. So you've got A, B, and A plus B. And this perhaps will explain it a little better. lost it.
Thankfully, 15 years ago, my automobile was a bath charmer and bring it right back.
Well, now how these got out of place, I don't know. There's the feather. That becomes the Fibonacci series, which is the same, and it's 43 to 117. Go, but people like Bragdon and Hamlin and Le Corbusier are very definite about this, that the proportion is there and is used consciously or unconsciously by the artist. Now, you can say it's the old question of which comes first, the chicken or the egg. But it doesn't really matter in that the proportion, the golden mean, is there in every satisfying work of art in some form or other. Does that make it easier?
Yeah.
And that's that root 5 proportion, the horrible little bit of mathematics. I'm sorry, but I would like just to talk about this. This is what they call a logarithmic spiral, which is built from the golden mean, and which gives you this spiral form, which is one of the bases of the whole of manifestation. And it's also called the whirling rectangle, because it goes round and round. And it's, of course, the basis of the cone, the logarithmic cone, where all these spirals conform to that formation, which comes again from the golden mean. The A is to B as B is to A plus B, that proportion. And this is the way Claude Bragdon thought. Right? You're intimidating me. there it is, is what he calls the whirling, in this case, squares.
That's the same proportion.
Pardon?
Snail's farm.
The snail's farm. This is what generates the spiral.
Yeah.
That you use so often in nature in many, many different ways. Now, let's go on quickly. This is the one I want to come to. Now, this spiral, if you can think of it here as a spiral, bigger and bigger and bigger, and then coming back again, is the basic, to me, the basic outbreathing and inbreathing of the universe. And you will find this when we come to self-realization by Dr. Tanya. He uses the same analogy for human consciousness. He says it is brought into the bindu, which is nothing, it expands out and comes back again. It's a question of contraction, expansion, out and back again. It's like the whirlwind. You see, the whirlwind comes down, gathering pressure to an absolute point. At that point it can pick up houses and scatter them far and wide, then willy-nilly, as you call them here, and then it becomes scattered again. So actually it's said that I think that this is one of the basic forms in the whole of the universe, because it is coming to a point of maximum pressure and then an expansion out again. Remember I said that consciousness, as Mr. Gardner saw it, was this throb of the universe, the in-breathing and the out-breathing. And this is the mathematical way of expressing that. It can also be seen as a fourth-dimensional fourth-dimensional sphere, but I don't know if that's really important. Would you like to ask questions about that one before I take part in the call? I'm nearly finished. Last question later. There's another way of looking at that. The same thing, of course, is there in the S-curve. Here you have this going down to nothing, and then this one coming down to nothing. Now, there's something wrong with that diagram. Do you know what it is? The yang and the yin, yes, but that's all right. There ought to be central dots, because the central dot, like the four in the tetractys, is the generating point. This comes down, goes to nothing, and comes up at the new dimension to a point there. And then this one comes down and comes up to a new dimension at a point there, sort of wells up. It's the same thing, only this is the balance in symmetry of the yin and the yang, the positive and the negative. And so you must have those, just as you must have the point in the center of the interlaced triangles to make the thing work, as it were. I'm going to get out to school early today. Oh, there's some more. This is the magic squares and things. This is done by, I don't think we'll go into this, but it's in some of Rod Bragdon's books, and they're most interesting. I put them on just to show them to you. There's the magic square past my finger. And you can see here how this happens, so that you get, in the magic square, you add these up across like this, and they all come to the same, and they all add up to the same. It's part of this, it's a sort of a carryover of the Pythagorean arithmetic into a new field, a fascinating field. And this, of course, is the magic lines and magic squares, and this again is where you trace the unit, the digit through. And just, I put it on because it's such a beautiful drawing. This is one of Todd Bradburn's, I think, from Frozen Fountain. Yes, it will be. Another, I'm sorry about this slide, it's a very bad one, but I thought this is such a beautiful, the form in it is so wonderful. And Sinbad, he always takes Sinbad as the human consciousness. Sinbad sees in the bouncing and retreating wave the epitome of the life process, the in-breathing and the out-breathing. And also you can consider man as the magic square. This has been carried out by many, the hands spread out are equal to the height, and the proportion here, the heart comes about there, and so on. It's got, they feel that it has significance. And Le Corbusier, the architect, the French architect, carried this a lot further. And this, I think, comes from his book, The Modular, because he used this golden mean in various forms. These triangles conform to the golden mean, but not this in the strict sense that I showed it before. And then he relates those golden mean rectangles to the human form. And therefore, that's the relationship that is important in architecture, because that space or that area relates to the human. And that's what he calls the modular, which again, it all comes from this golden mean, the root five that frightened you all. That was me. I don't think there are any more.